This News Talk 1010 podcast is brought to you by PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca. Wrongfully dismissed? Changes made to your job? Lowballed on severance? Find out if you have a case before you call a lawyer. Go to PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca.
Time to feel the rush of the round table. Brought to you by PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca. Are you really an independent contractor? Find out in seconds for free at PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca.
Ryan Doyle, Rejmi Nair here on The Rush this afternoon. Let's welcome in the roundtable. I apologize to our friend Trevor Mayo for giving him a heart attack if you heard that, but he's not on the show today. But there you go. These things happen. Jaskaran Sandhu is here, senior consultant at Crestview. Nice to have you, sir.
Hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you. And also Amanda Galbraith, principal at Navigator. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off with a conversation that we were just having when it comes to education. The Minister of Education today coming out announcing that he is going to fix the long talked about math curriculum here in the province of Ontario.
I would argue from a competitive landscape, we must take action immediately to improve math scores. We were given a mandate by the people of this province to go back to basics, bring a math curriculum that actually reflects the priorities of the job market. There is, you know, it is not, you know, disconnected. The fact that we have twice the rate of youth unemployment, the fact that there's a 200% debt to income ratio for young people in this province. We've got to do better at the foundations of math, numeracy, financial literacy. These are the things we know we need to do better at.
Jaskaran, when I hear something like that, I think, yeah, long overdue. The teachers are saying today that, well, you know, we needed more time. We recommended that this be implemented within the next 2 years. So they're upset about it. But the education minister says, yeah, we're gonna implement this, and it's going to happen in September, whether you like it or not, with things like financial literacy and other basics of math.
Yeah, I think this is, I think these are much needed changes to the math curriculum in Ontario. And this is just a lot of common sense stuff in here that makes a lot of sense. And it's something that long overdue, and there's a bit of a stagnation in math and math scores in Ontario, and it was long overdue. And it's great to see that changes are coming in, and there's no time like now.
Amanda, I know you work in a world where adapting to new circumstances is basically what you do on a daily basis. So when you hear a profession, at least their union, let's be fair, it's not everybody, but at least their union say, oh, well, we're going to need a lot of time to adapt to this. We can't just do it overnight. What do you think?
Listen, I think I'm willing to give them a little bit on it, only because I think, for example, the way the government's rolled out the schooling regulations and that kind of stuff, I think has been a bit ham-fisted. So I think sometimes they rush stuff out really fast because it looks good. I will say this. I think they have 3 months. I recognize they're probably a little more work than they would typically do over the summer, but I do think this is a really wonderful, smart program. I wish I knew stuff about investing as opposed to Pythagorean theorem, which is the only thing I remember from algebra. And, you know, I hope they can maybe just put a little bit of extra effort into it and do this for the kids, because our math scores are terrible. The minister is correct. We need to be more practical. I don't love the messaging around back to basics, but because basic math is not basic to me, but I do think the focus on stuff that is actually useful makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, I mean, so when you think about the timeline in 2020, I'm trying to get Ryan on board with some of the concerns that are at least being flagged. Do any of you hear from teachers who are concerned about learning all of these things before they're able to teach them?
I have not heard anything like personally directly, but actually truthfully I haven't asked a teacher about it. Yeah, I mean, if some of this stuff is conceptually complicated, if I was a teacher, I don't know very much about investing. So, but then again, I think, you know, it's part of your job. You have 3 months. I hope you can kind of manage it. And if there's an issue, hopefully they can flag it or get extra support. Maybe that's part of the government doing, is giving them extra support or extra training over the summer to roll this out properly. But I think 2 years to me just seems a bit excessive.
Just Karen, when I hear this, people are saying, well, do you work during your vacation? Why do you expect teachers to work during their vacation? If we're talking about these being different times, well, we've had a few months away from the office, away from work. And the truth be told, yeah, I think everybody at some point in time has worked on their vacation.
Yeah, I work during my vacations, as much as that annoys everyone around me that's trying to be on vacation with me. The curriculum needs changing. We're in unusual circumstances, and the normal is kind of gone out the window. And the last 3-4 months has not necessarily been how we tended to plan and use our time. And that goes for folks like us that are working from home, and folks in teaching and other industries and sectors. So at the end of the day, you got to do what you got to do. And I think the time's now to push forward on this and kind of implement the new curriculum as best suited for the kids.
Let's talk a little bit about Toronto's CAMH today. They say police should not be first responders to mental health calls here in the city of Toronto. In fact, they've been working with Peel Region for the last little while, and here's how some of their mobile crisis operation actually works. Take a listen.
Currently, we have 10 operational teams, which consist of a specially trained officer and a registered nurse who specializes in mental health or forensic psychology, which actually is 85 calls a day that we handle.
Wow.
As a service by officers, frontline officers, and there's rarely any incidences where they end up tragically. The officers do a fantastic job day in, day out, and not just in Toronto Police Service, but I might add across this country.
Amanda, this comes as, of course, Toronto Police and a number of other police divisions around North America and around the world, for that matter, take a look at how to do things differently going forward.
Yeah, I think this makes it, frankly, I think this makes a ton of sense. And I think we've been kind of getting here over the course of the last few years. I think, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and the focus around the police and their engagement in our society has sped this up. I mean, right now, basically, the police are the catch-all, right? They are the, they get the cat of the tree. If the guy, you know, your car is broken into, if there's a major shooting, like, if that's a big gamut. If it's a mental health call, that actually, I don't think any human can do all of those things. So for us to develop, like, specialized groups or forces or teams that maybe are with the police or are without the police, whatever that works, to me is, I think, the right way to move forward. It would stop, hopefully, some of these tragedies from happening, not all of them, but a lot of them. So I'd love to see more partnerships like this or CAMH or an organization like that taking the lead.
The cat out of the tree.
Well, you know, people get cats. They did that in Leslieville. It happened.
That's the best visual I've had all day.
There you go.
It's a bunch of cops sitting around going, how are we going to get this one out? What is that, a tabby? Yeah, let's be very careful with those.
Here to serve, Ryan, here to serve.
Jaskaran, when you hear this, it does make a ton of sense. I don't know why we need, you know, all of what's gone on to get to this point, but here we are.
Well, I think this goes back to the argument around this phrase, defund the police. And part of the meaning and the background on that is reallocating funds that are being used through policing resources to supports and services and institutions that will actually assist either marginalized communities or folks that are dealing with things like mental health issues. And, you know, CAMH said it loud and clear, and there's a credible voice and authority in the space that, you know, police should not be the first responders to mental health calls. That, you know, they're not necessarily equipped with the same training a mental health experts are given. And again, they're coming in with a different frame and point of view than a mental health worker would. Let's provide more resources to the folks in the mental health sector to be able to handle calls like this. And obviously, there's cases where safety is a concern and an officer may be required to attend. But in the majority of these cases, I think going back to the clip that you put at the start, in the majority of the cases, that's not what's happening. And mental health workers are fully equipped to handle a lot of these calls. And they won't end in the tragedy that we've been seeing just lately, including in Malton mm-hmm. here and Peel and elsewhere.
So we're talking about police presence in dealing with mental health. Let's pivot to schools, because a Hamilton school board voted last night to scrap a program that had police officers in elementary and high schools. What do you guys think about that, Jaskaran?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest critiques of having officers in schools is that it inflames tension or it creates an awkward space for folks or for students from marginalized communities. And I think we have to take that into consideration, right? Like a school place, schools, an institution of education is not necessarily a space where we should be expecting officers to kind of roam around. Because there is an implication and there is a, you know, there's an undertone there that, you know, you're being watched and monitored. And I went to a school that was very diverse, and I remember this vividly when in high school that we didn't necessarily see the police there as kind of an educational soft touch thing, is that we were being watched as members of marginalized communities. So it makes a ton of sense to have them removed from the premises, because schools are for education and not necessarily for having folks there that you know, create a certain amount of tension that's that makes it an awkward space for folks that are from marginalized community or a threatening space.
Yeah, it would be nice to have that community feeling where everyone smiles and says hello. But I remember when I would see cops in schools and then it would be a half smile. Like, I'm not really sure. Are you here to see me? I don't want you to talk to me. What do we do? Amanda, what are your thoughts on that?
I hear that, and I remember we had kind of a very vigorous debate about it in Toronto. I think it was a couple years ago around this, and they eventually did, I think, pause or halt the program. You know, I think it's unfortunate that we've had to get that way, because I do think community policing itself, like that kind of, you know, being in communities, being out and about, is the only way we kind of get to a place where the police can actually, you know, credibly do their job. Unfortunately, you know, we have these fissures within their relationships with racialized communities, with the Black community, and rightfully so. So I think this is part and parcel with some repair work, is, you know, in order to be in a place where it's, you know, people are comfortable with you being in the school environment, we have to repair the trust with the community in general. And I truly hope that, you know, this Toronto Police Service and Regional Police Service are really seized with that, so that we can get to a place where they can be welcomed back in schools, as opposed to looked at as sort of this omnipotent sort of threat.
The government could be doing more to get Canadians Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig out of jail in China, according to Michael Kovrig's wife, saying that the words are no longer enough. And when you hear that, Just Karen, that seems to be directed straight towards the Prime Minister of this country. I've been saying for quite a while that he can't talk his way out of this situation. Now that the wife of Michael Kovrig has weighed in, do you think that's going to change things and perhaps get some action to get these men out of China and out of the situation that they're in?
I hope it changes something. And I think we tend to see a situation and issues like this kind of an abstract chess pieces on a, you know, geopolitical and foreign affairs, international, intrigue, and not necessarily see the human costs associated with things like this. While Canada and China, or the West and China, may be fighting it out or finding their spheres of influence within the global politics today, There's two innocent people in jail right now. And, you know, we've talked about this before, where the conviction rate in China is 100%. And there's a very likelihood that these two individuals are not going to have a happy ending at the end of this. And that has a very serious human cost. There's a cost here beyond just Canada's reputation or diplomatic relations with China. Their lives at stake here. And the Prime Minister and this government have to do more in tackling that and facing up against China and the aggression that we're seeing coming from China elsewhere in the world as well.
Amanda, from a communications point of view, I thought it was smart for, you know, Kovrig's wife to, you know, speak out, start doing interviews to keep pressure on Ottawa, because last time I saw the Prime Minister, he was, you know, he was doing the old thoughts and prayers routine, and I think that's worn out its welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. I cannot imagine how frustrated this woman must be. I think her comments today were measured. I think it's, you know, I would be flipping out and screaming. So, I think it's important that she speaks up, right? I think it, as far as telling a story, it lends a human impact to it. We hear, but you know, he's been in a room with the lights on for, you know, over a year. I can't sleep with like a nightlight on in the court. I can't even imagine what he's going through. So I think putting this front and center, Canadians saying your government is frankly failing this family and failing these individuals, and they need to be held accountable, is the right thing to do, and I hope they keep it up.
Amanda, Just Karen, thank you so much. We appreciate it today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This News Talk 1010 podcast was brought to you by PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca. Wrongfully dismissed? Changes made to your job? Lowballed on severance? Find out if you have a case before you call a lawyer. Go to PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca.